Here, special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, John Wallach, Vestica Darz, and to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Krug-Meadows, Carla DeJesus, and Phil Raymond. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for all of our interviews with Noam Chomsky, as we've interviewed him over the years, and for any of the broadcasts we have done. The transcripts, the video, the audio podcast, check out democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our host, Joe Uris. Today's guests are Ron Narod and Kelly Cowan with Portland State University, and we'll talk about labor relations.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. for the Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and electronic artists from around the globe. Win tickets and stay up on events each and every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on The Melting Pot, right here at 90.7 FM KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor a salsa dance party to celebrate 17 years of the Community Alliance of Tenants, the only statewide grassroots tenants rights organization. December 6th, from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m., this party will include a light dinner buffet, short program, and salsa lesson. It will take place at the Grand Cafe at 832 Southeast Grand Avenue in Portland, Oregon. Again, that's the Community Alliance of Tenants Salsa Party, December 6th, from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Grand Cafe. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University, with five-part MBA programs that combine classic business skills with an emphasis on creative thinking, ethical decision-making, and sound judgment, the hallmarks of a liberal arts perspective. December 5th evening information session, details at merrillhurst.edu.
I'm a blue-collar worker. Yes, I'm a blue-collar worker. I'm a blue-collar worker. Hope my check's gonna cover my bill. I work hard every day. Well, I work hard every day. I said I work hard every day. I wonder when they're gonna raise my pay. Yes, I'm a blue-collar worker. Well, I'm a blue-collar worker. Well, I'm a blue-collar worker. Working hard every day. I got the boss on my back. I got the boss on my back. I got the boss on my back. Tell me, how am I supposed to act? Things are so unfair. Things are so unfair. Things are so unfair. working hard but going nowhere. Yes, I'm a blue-collar worker.
Yeah, a blue-collar worker. Well, we're going to talk about unionization, we're going to talk about union problems, and we're going to talk about intellectual workers today. I've got three people from the faculty of Portland State University joining us. This is KBOO, 90.7 on your FM dial here in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Abe isn't here. It's me, Joe Uris. And the number to call is 231-8187. It is, of course, Talk Radio, and we have guests, and I want to give them each an opportunity. They'll identify themselves, and they'll explain what's going on at Portland State. And I'm arbitrarily running from left to right. I should tell you, all of you, that there are two labor organizations for faculty at Portland State University. There is the AAUP. I'm very fond of saying it that way because I regard it as a sort of intellectual organization, and several years ago when they had an opportunity to decide on what labor organization to take, the faculty decided to go with the intellectual one, the high-end one. And that's why I make that teasing sound when I describe it. The rest of the faculty and growing majority of the faculty are members of the American Federation of Teachers, which is an AFL-CIO affiliated union, and has traditionally believed in a more militant stance. However, times are changing, the power of faculty are changing, and the ratio of faculty who are tenured track, I should explain that. When you enter a university system as a teacher, you traditionally would be admitted to a department to work in that department after a certain period of time during which you're expected to publish academic articles and books. You are moved to tenure. Tenure is a guarantee, more or less, that unless you do something really evil, you have a permanent job. You have a position which you can work at until you retire. The idea of tenure is not just to give people job security, but to give them intellectual security. And this is really an important point. People miss it often. If I choose, let us say I'm a tenured faculty member, to write about how brilliant, whatever, the Nazis, the communists, the gay front for the liberation of dogs, whatever, and I write an article or a book, and it's not well received, I still keep my position. I am secure in my research as long as my research is academically based and reasonable, as long as I don't violate certain sets of rules. I'm secure in that position. That gives me freedom to do my research. And if you want an institutional structure for education and for learning and for research, you need to have that tenure. Now, the issue that we're going to be looking at, the issues we're going to be looking at are the standard issues of labor, hours, job security, wages, and so on. But the other part of this is a transition that is taking place all over the United States, in which the number of tenured faculty in any given university or college keeps shrinking, while the part-timers and what's called fixed-term contract people are the dominant faculty. And that has enormous implications for research and freedom. It also has enormous implications for job security. And it is a serious dilemma. It is taking place in the context of an increasing use of the cloud, of courses that are off out of the classroom and online rather than in the classroom itself. So I'm going to start with I'm going to ask each of you to identify yourselves and what affiliation you have.
Okay, well, I'm Kelly Cowan, and I'm the president of the PSU Faculty Association. That's the AFL-CIO-affiliated one that Joe Uris mentioned. And we represent part-time faculty and researchers at Portland State University. We, like he was mentioning, we teach about 35% of the credit hours on campus, although we bring in a lot of revenue for the university, we have very little job security, and that was one of our big issues in our contract negotiations that we just actually recently concluded. So I can talk a little more about that in a moment. As far as my background, I have a background in management and marketing of technology. I've taught both marketing classes in the business school, and I'm currently a researcher in the engineering management department.
Okay.
My name is Leanne Cerbulo, and I'm a fixed-term instructor, as Joe Yoris just mentioned. I'm one of those non-tenure-track faculty members. I teach in University Studies, which is a general education program at Portland State, and I'm also a member of the AAUP collective bargaining team.
I'm Ron Narode. I'm the vice president for collective bargaining at Portland State's AAUP chapter. I have been at Portland State for 23 years. I've been teaching in higher ed since 1981, and I'm a math and science teacher educator in the Graduate School of Education.
Yeah, a full disclosure here for me. I have taught and been involved in union work at Clackamas Community College, where I had tenure, and was head of the OEA, Oregon Education Association, higher ed group for the state. Also, I was hired by Roger Bassett, representing the state, then the second term of Governor Kitzhaber, and Michael Reardon, who was then provost at Portland State University, and John Kaiser, who was president of Clackamas Community College, in an effort to build something that seems to be surviving, which is a relationship between the community colleges and the universities. Prior to that effort, it was hit or miss. A student could finish a certain set of courses, which was the requirement of the first 2 years of college, and be guaranteed a position at Portland State if they successfully did that. But the process of moving from one institution to another was marred by all kinds of rules and regulations and confusions, and we discovered that when we looked at students' patterns of utilization of higher ed, they moved around. They took courses here or there. They went up or down in the system. They, in general, needed a guideline and an easy path, including the ability to use the libraries and the admissions office and so on at the university. At the same time, the university was developing a new approach to the basic first two-year education program, which is called University Studies, which was just mentioned. And we'll talk about that maybe, but it's not so important to what we're discussing today. What you do need to know is that in higher education throughout the United States right now, there is an effort to push out tenured faculty, to set limits on the ability of the independent scholar to gain job security. That is virtually in every state in the union. And at Portland State, more and more faculty seem to be people brought in as part-timers or fixed-term contract people. That saves money for the institution, but it also, as I said a little bit earlier, really does set a kind of psychological, if not actual, limits on people's sense of academic freedom. Academic freedom is a very important right in education, particularly at the higher education level. If you don't have that, you're going to either psychologically or directly want to limit your research in any area where there might be controversy, and that really does restrict the freedom to do research, and it also restricts the ability to discover new things. So it's a very important issue, in addition to the question of the need of faculty to have a living wage. So what I'm going to do here, mm-hmm. you guys just completed a bargaining thing.
Yeah,
I'm going to have you start with what you asked for, what you got.
Okay,
and then I'm going to turn to you and discuss where AAUP is in all of this process. Again, I want to emphasize that we're dealing with intellectual workers here. And many of you out there have jobs that are not considered intellectual work, though they may well be. And it is in our society, which tends to, I believe, dis intellectual workers, mm-hmm. it's hard to understand the issues that are involved. So I really want to get into this, and I know that people out there would probably want to call in 231-8187, but why don't you go ahead?
All right. So because we just finished our contract negotiations last week, and we're working on contract ratification actually this week, I guess that it's easier to look back and see some of the struggles and some of what we got. Basically, the big issues for a lot of my members are really around just what you say with job security. It used to be when were part-time faculty at Portland State and you had taught a certain number of terms. I sometimes get these figures wrong. I think it was like 3 out of the last 6 terms, you could automatically get a type of assignment right that it didn't guarantee you much, but it said that you'd at least have a multi-term contract. You wouldn't have to wait until the term was right about to begin to see, do I have a job? And two contract cycles ago, we were in some tough negotiations, much like I'd compare it to the negotiations this time. And it seemed like the be-all and end-all issue for the administration was to get rid of those assignment rights. And it was funny because at the time, the excuse was that there were a lot of economic issues. But in the long run, money wasn't what it came down to. It really seemed like they said they needed that flexibility to be able to let you go whenever they wanted. And we were able to replace that with something else, with an evaluation process that allows people to go through a longer, more complex process to get a long-term contract. But that process has turned out to have a lot of kinks in it. And so we have, in our negotiations, we were really working to try to get some kind of short-term job security for people. Once they've taught and proven themselves, after a short time, they should be able to have some kind of security in their job. And then, yes, long-term, it's great to have evaluations and something more approaching the concept of tenure. But as part-time faculty, it's not something that we've really been able to achieve. And we hope that we can keep these discussions going. In this contract, the job security issues were basically not things we could talk, or not things that we were able to move much on. We had asked for some pay increases too, because part-time faculty are among the lowest paid academic workers at you know, PSU and virtually all universities, although we bring in a huge percentage of revenue for the university. So, for instance, we bring in nearly, or actually over $55 million in revenue for PSU, which is actually more than I think the state currently provides to PSU. But again, we're some of the lowest paid workers. So we wanted to try to get comparable increases to some of our peers at other institutions. University of Oregon, they just negotiated a contract and they got around an 8% increase per year. And a number of other universities in the state, I think Western Oregon University got a pretty good increase too. So we were asking for similar things, you know, compared to a set of 10 comparator universities. Portland State rates 10th out of 10 in terms of faculty compensation. And among that list, the part-time faculty are you know, the lowest there. What we were actually able to get, we definitely were in some very tough negotiations. We managed to get approximately 3% increases for each of the next 2 years, and we managed to get some very modest increases to some of our benefit funds. So we don't get a lot of benefits, but we do have some funds that allow us to attend professional conferences, and those are actually something that we had been running out of. If you're a part-time faculty and you have sort of a connection to outside companies and you need to keep your skills current, you really need to go to conferences. You need to be able to network. And if you were to divide up the amount of money in our funds by our total members, it would come out to very little. So we pushed to get an increase to that fund and managed to get it was about a $40,000 per year fund. You know, this is for like over 1,000 part-time faculty. We have a fund that I think now will have about $85,000 in it, and so you do the math. $85,000 divided by 1,000, it wouldn't go very far.
Now, one of the things that I learned over the years is that there's a, what used to be called freeway flyers.
Oh, yeah.
These are people who, in order to make a living for their families and themselves, will teach maybe a class or two at Portland State, one or two classes at Clackamas Community College, one or two classes at Mount Hood, and so on. And they'll be rushing from location to location, and we'll be able to cobble together maybe a living wage.
Yeah.
But there's no tenure, there's no upward mobility, there's just the limits of the contract, whatever that happens to be at that particular institution. And, of course, it doesn't create a community of scholars,
right,
which is part of the mythos, if not the reality, of university life. So I just wanted to, I don't know what our audience knows about this, and I just wanted to make that clear. The university is often seen as a la-di-da spot. Portland State is not, I would not say, a place like Stanford or, I don't know, the Sunny System in New York or any of those places. People are not making the kind of money that you see at the major universities in the United States, and this has impact also in hiring. If I'm going to choose, if I have a good publishing record and I'm a hot commodity on the market in any field, I probably get to choose an opening in many places. Portland State, unless I have a particular desire to live in Portland, Oregon, which I never have understood, but if you do, Portland, that would be the only reason why you'd particularly choose here. You would go here as a necessary choice for career move. It without the kind of money and without the kind of status that we have, there are real costs in the situation. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, and I really think this is important, there is a wave of effort to create an insecure, I think that's the right word, an insecure professoriate. And that is a very dangerous thing for all kinds of reasons. Those of you who are old enough may even remember the McCarthy period when professors were hounded, lost their jobs, even at places at Reed College, which is a relatively secure institution. And the guarantee of academic freedom becomes extremely important under those conditions. So there are two kinds of issues. The first issue is the basic issues of organized labor or any laboring force, you know, benefits, wages, and so on. And the second issue is what kinds of conditions in terms of your career activities and your research and so on exist. And these both are interrelated and are very powerful issues around which there are struggles always. And right now, I believe in the pattern of American organized labor and in the pattern of intellectual life in our society, things are going what I would call backward. And I want you to talk about the situation of the AAUP. I understand you're still engaged in negotiations.
Yes, Joe, we are. This is Ron Narode. I'd like to just let the listener know that, first of all, AAUP is the American Association of University Professors. It was an organization that began soon after World War I. It was actually showed up in the rise of the fascist governments in Europe, and it was a response by intellectuals like John Dewey to set up an organization that would protect academic freedom so that faculty could speak out and loudly and safely about the political situations, economic situations, as well as the scientific and intellectual pursuits that they had. The AAUP at Portland State, we've been there for 35 years. I have only been there for 23, but AAUP has been a large part of the faculty life at Portland State. We represent the full-time academic workers, and there are three groups of us. As Joe mentioned, there are the tenured and tenure-track faculty. There are the full-time contract mostly annual workers who have who teach classes at Portland State. In fact, a larger number of them than many of the rest of us do, the tenured faculty. And there are the academic professionals, the people who do the advising for students, and they run the health services, they are doctors, there are many people on campus who make it work. AUP at Portland State represents over 800, we represent over 1,500 people and we have voting members of in excess of 820 of us. And what we have done, every 2 years, we get into collective bargaining. And what we do in collective bargaining is we ensure that our contract is strong, we improve upon it, and we look for advances in faculty governance as well as faculty salary and benefits. So we have a big charge. The contract also gives faculty the right to make grievances when they feel that their rights have been abused. And so we have two vice presidents in AAUP. One is for collective bargaining, that's myself, and another vice president is for grievances. And both of us protect the contract. And in terms of incomes, how Portland State compares to other institutions that are like us around the country, we are at the very bottom. According to the Oregon University System's own survey, Portland State is 10th among 10 likely comparable institutions. Among our colleagues, we surveyed our colleagues to find out from their perspective, knowing their disciplines, what percentage of them thought that their salaries and workloads were competitive with other institutions and colleagues around the country. 81% of them reported back to us that Portland State was not competitive compared to those. Only 10% of them thought that Portland State was competitive. So it's an 8-to-1 ratio of faculty who understand their own fields and know what the situation is. Now, I know that many of you might think that professors and people in higher education earn a lot of money. The minimum qualification for jobs in among members in our unit and also for Kelly's unit would be a master's degree. Many of the members have doctorates. The average salary for all of the people that we represent is around $54,000 a year. That is the average. Now, there are some members who are earning in excess of that significantly. Full professors who have been around for a long time and are very accomplished and in fields that are very competitive, such as business or engineering. Those folks would be earning competitive salaries beyond that. But for most of our members, the salaries are much lower. And I'm sure that Kelly could give a good idea of what members in his unit are earning as well.
Yeah, it's considerably lower on average than what you're mentioning, because all of our members teach under 0.49 full-time equivalent. So, I mean, these are all people that are kept right under the half-time threshold, so that they don't end up having to be paid any of the normal benefits that you'd get as an employee. So, except for those one or two little benefits I mentioned, which I explained don't go too far. So I don't have an exact figure for what our average member makes, but I can tell you that in our recent negotiations, we looked at how many of our members were at the minimum salary rate, and
What is that?
Well, okay, so the minimum rate is a per credit hour. It probably sounds high because it's around $809 per credit hour. But what it really comes out to is that you teach a class an entire term and you might get paid a couple thousand dollars to teach the entire class. When you add this up, if you taught the total number of classes that you were allowed to teach in any given year, and beyond that you'd no longer be half-time or less, then generally our members wouldn't make more than around about $40,000. Now, you mentioned the freeway flyers, or sometimes road scholars, as we call them, people who have to jump on the road and go from campus to campus. And many people do try to cobble together a full-time job out of a lot of part-time teaching jobs. So in previous surveys, we found a large percentage of our members are doing that because there's just not an opportunity to get tenure-track jobs, to know that you have the security at one place and your classes won't be canceled at the beginning of the next term. So, yes, a large percentage of our members teach just a few classes and definitely are not high-paid workers for their qualifications.
Yeah, Leanne, I want you to talk a little bit about the situation you're in, because it's somewhere between, I would say.
Right. Yeah, so we have, our job security is similar to the part-time instructors. We have very little of it. Most of us work on annual contracts, which means basically we're hired and fired and rehired every single year. So we have a contract that lasts from the beginning of the school year, September, till June. And then we have to have our contract renewed each year. So there's a possibility that we won't be renewed every single year. In terms of salary and wages, even though we're full-time teaching or research professionals, our starting wage starts at about $37,000 a year. So many of the fixed-term instructors and fixed-term research professionals at Portland State do have doctorate degrees, but our starting wage is around $37,000 a year. And prior to coming on as a full-time worker about 4 years ago, I was also a part-time faculty member, and I had taught my maximum amount of credits that I could possibly teach, and I was earning $15,000 a year. So that's just
to
give you...
We're only making 15 grand?
As a part-time instructor, yes.
Yeah. I want to mention something to people. Many people who are blue-collar workers, casual workers or whatever, working possibly at a Walmart or whatever, would say, oh, those are really good wages. I think it's important to understand the investment that a person puts into getting to the place where they can work in a university. It is a long haul, and it is expensive, and there is not a lot of free money out there anymore. So your your personal investment in the process is not unlike that of other professions, lawyers or doctors or whatever. Mm-hmm. And your yield is not anywhere like that of lawyers and doctors and so on. So it is a work of love and of commitment to education. Meanwhile, there is, again, I think I mentioned this, but it's really important, there is this pattern of attempting to limit both the influence or power and the numbers of people who really have tenure in the university system. I believe this is not a coincidence. It's not an accident. I think it's a pattern that reflects a growing attempt to turn the university into a kind of, professional school for people to serve the ruling class. I'm going to say that because I don't know how else to describe it. You're not looking for the Noam Chomskys of the world to be at places like Portland State or any other university. What you're really looking for is people who will teach to the book, to the text, essentially making sure that they stay within certain kinds of bounds. Now, we have callers, and I want to give those people an opportunity. So if you're interested, we're talking about higher education and about the struggles that are involved. I also want to mention that it's interesting that they settled with the part-timers ahead of the AAUP. I don't want to sound conspiratorial here, but if I was an administrator and I was trying to deal with organized labor, the thing I would do would be to settle with my part-timers first, because I could always say to any AAUP or other full-time organization, well, you know, we have people with PhDs waiting for an opportunity to teach, a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and I think that's part of the strategy of the system. And I also think that Portland State in the system is the hard case. Again, full disclosure, I worked there. I'm familiar with the institution from a while back, and I've worked in the community college system. So I see the whole higher ed, the whole pattern of higher ed in the state. And I want to take some calls now. 231-8187. Joanne, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you, guests, for being on Joe's program. I heard that Janet Napolitano, who is head of the Homeland Security Department, is now head of the California University System. I wonder if that's a bad signal for the students there and the professors and that. And also, across the country, the professors and that in other colleges and universities, knowing this. I wonder if it's going to affect their thinking and behaviors. Anyway, thank you. Bye.
Yeah, thanks for the call. I don't know how to answer that question. I actually don't know her academic background. I know that the California system has undergone periodically enormous upheavals. Mm-hmm. It is a very large university system. And of course, most of its universities are high status, and notably, University of California, Berkeley, very high status. Anybody have a comment on Napolitano's employment? I think everyone's
really
going to pass on that, Joanne, so we'll move on. You know, I find this issue of faculty both faculty governance and faculty salaries and benefits very, very crucial to the development of the intelligentsia, the folks who think about things and talk about things and write about things, and to the development of students who also can think about, talk about, write about things. If we turn our whole, if we vocationalize our university system, which seems to me to be part of the pattern we're seeing, we are going to produce people who might be very competent or even brilliant engineers or whatever, but we will not produce a population of individuals who really think for themselves and who really follow the pattern of a concern for critical thought. And I'm personally very much committed to the idea that the professoriate, the academic community's teachers, should be teaching and urging people to think about things in a critical way. I see our society sliding, this is my personal view, slowly and steadily into a kind of friendly fascism. And I think that pattern is reflected also in the university system. So one of the reasons why I wanted to have you guys in here is to talk about this. We are not, we don't have a representative of the Portland Association of Teachers. They are in a struggle now with an administration that's, I think, quite hostile. Their situation is even more dire and even more significantly compromised than the academic communities of the universities and colleges in the state. And I wanted to mention that. And sometime in the future, we will invite them here to talk with us. People may say, "Well, why don't you ask the administration to come in?" Well, because I have, over the years, had a lot of experience having been an administrator in how they operate. And this kind of conversation, the only way it can work would be under very much different circumstances than the show allows. I will ask the administration to come in, though, at some time in the future.
Joe? So, this is Ron Narode.
I guess you should identify yourselves by voice.
I'm leading the bargaining team for AUP at present, and this is my third bargaining round, and to speak to the issue of really the ability of faculty to speak freely and engage in their work in the best possible way for the students is really at issue very much in our contract negotiations at present.
How so?
The university, we started negotiating in March, and in April, the administration gave me a letter, hand-delivered, from their attorney that said that there were articles in our contract that they did not want in the contract, that we were not permitted to speak about, and we are not permitted to strike over. Now, this may sound strange to the listener, but in fact, in Oregon, there are laws about what may be negotiated in a contract and what may not. And for government workers, there are articles in a contract that are called permissive. Now, permissive articles are the kinds of things that deal with issues not having to deal with working conditions, money, and benefits. Instead, they're things that deal with things like faculty evaluation. Now, faculty evaluations are very important. How staff are evaluated very much has to do with how the university has worked for many, many years. So, for example, peers evaluate their peers because they know best what they are about. They know what their research agenda is, they know what the field is, and so we have a long tradition of this kind of evaluation. The university wants to strike much of the language that we had, in fact, entire articles that we had in our contract for many years, articles that have been bargained over to be the best possible kinds of evaluation procedures to reduce the numbers of grievances over time and to get the fairest evaluation for faculty. This was struck from our contract, much as what Portland Public Schools have tried to do with their teachers. So this is not a particularly unique situation in the country right now. It is unique in terms of the history of higher education and education generally and the kinds of contracts we have had. In three contract negotiations that we've had, that I have personally been involved in, the last three, up until now, we have always had university administrators who have either taught themselves or supervised other people who teach and work in the academic environment. At present, there is only one member, the vice provost, on the administration team, who has that background. The other two members are not from the academy. They are attorneys, and it's changed the environment tremendously. We feel that we do not have someone across the table, a team across the table from us, that really understands the faculty life and needs and the university as it operates for the benefit of all of our students. And this is unique.
I didn't realize that. I find this really scary. I can see how that could be disastrous for faculty and for independent research and thought and independence in the classroom. I don't know how much our audience understands of the importance of this issue. I want to step back again to something I mentioned earlier. It was during the era we call the McCarthy era, where we discovered how limited faculty's freedom of speech could really be. Mm-hmm. And there's been a struggle since then to regain or to gain for everybody a security in their teaching and their research. To have people who have no real traditional orientation or background in academics opposite you in a negotiation can be very, very severe. When I worked at Portland State, the provost was an academic who came out of the history department. There were things you could argue with him about, but he understood this fundamental truth. The same would be true, for example, Nohad Toulon, the late, very great leader of the Urban Studies program of the School of Urban Affairs, who also understood this issue. He came from Egypt. He understood these kinds of issues, and that would be true in almost all the departments I can think of in those days, and at the academic dean level. This is a real shift. This is a real shift that I didn't fully comprehend. Mm-hmm. When you're bargaining under these circumstances, you're talking to people who are probably essentially trying to carry out a agenda, which may be very alien to an academic community. I want to give people a chance to call us. It's 231-8187. Who do we have? Dave, you're on the air.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions that are not directly related, but probably close. One is, if they're trying to Waltonize their faculty salaries, but tuition keeps going up, who's getting more money, and why should they be getting more money, if they should at all? And I think, and this may verge on a type of bigotry that I'm not ashamed of at all, our society seems to have a terribly excessive regard for managers and not enough of one for academics. And I'll let you guys fight out over that one and get off the phone.
Yeah, I think that I'm going to let the AAUP people respond to this one right now, if you don't mind. I think some really serious issues are raised.
Okay. So again, Ron Rode, yes, excellent question. The faculty versus the administration salaries is one of the things I would like to talk with you about. So we did a study from 2002 until 2012. So we looked at a 10-year period of time to see how salaries compared. The president's salary on the what we call E&G funds rose by 90% in that 10-year period. The provost's salary shot up by 46%. Vice provost's average salary is left by 43%. Vice president's 29%. Associate vice president's 19%. And assistant vice president's by 23%. So let's compare that to the faculty. Between 2002 and 2012, the tenured full professors, their salaries rose by 6%. The tenured associate professors, that's just under the full professor status, these are tenured faculty, their salaries fell by 1%.
Wait a minute, fell by 1%?
They fell by 1%. The tenure track assistant professor salaries grew by 1%. The fixed-term assistant professors, they went up by 8%. I mean, you're getting the idea. Now, in terms of the fixed-term instructor salaries, the people who are offering by far, they're offering many, many classes at Portland State. This is what many of the students are paying their tuition dollars for. Their salaries fell by 7%. And the academic professionals, the people who do the advising for the students at Portland State, their salaries fell by 3%. So I think that shows you where the money is going. In terms of the percentage overall, Portland State has an overall budget of close to $500 million. Just to put a context on what Kelly was saying, when all of his over 800 faculty members will share the increase from $40,000 to $85,000 in their professional development fund. We're talking about a huge disparity. And 27% of the budget is actually going towards academics. Now, this is a drop.
Wait a minute. That blows my mind. You're saying that the actual teaching monies is 27% of the total budget of the university?
Yeah.
Where the hell's the other money going?
Well, good question.
Very good.
No, but there are tremendous costs in running a university, clearly. I mean, to have
They got rid of the union to do the cleanup work, the janitorial work, didn't they?
I asked AAUP National. I said, what would be a reasonable number? Now, in terms of what Portland State has been, we have been as high as 34%. So we haven't, I mean, that's typically what you will see at universities around the country. About 36% of their budget goes towards academic. It's dropped, and it's been dropping steadily at Portland State over the last 10 years. And that's the wrong trend, we believe. And it's also been dropping nationally. So when you're talking, Joe, about sort of national trends, yes, this is a national trend. AAUP National, our national union, when I ask them, what is the number that we should be looking at? Their answer is every state institution in the country should be shooting for a 50% of their total budget going towards academics. Mm-hmm. And this is an accountant at AAUP and the vice president for collective bargaining. 50% is the target, and we are moving further and further away from that target.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just get some sense of this. What does the president of Portland State make?
$512,000.
Wait, $500,000?
Yes.
I want to be a president.
It's probably even more. He gets additional benefits. He gets a house, a car. He gets paid by the PSU Foundation, and I don't think we even know exactly what some of those payments are. So his official salary is what they say, but he's well compensated.
And is are the other administrators similarly well paid for? I mean, I'm a little puzzled, you know.
This is Kelly Cowan from PSUFA. I know that we quoted a figure in our negotiations where we had learned that there were over 206 administrators at Portland State who made over $100,000 per year, and it was the highest per capita in the Oregon university system. And of that, I think it was about 50 of those people were well over the $100,000 mark. They were more in the $200,000 range. So you add up those figures, and this comes out to tens of millions of dollars. I mean, even just the, if you assumed everybody was making $100,000 by 206, you know, we're talking a huge chunk of the budget in administration. To put this another way, with members of my unit, I mentioned that we bring in about $55 million per year. Our salaries are about $5.5 million per year. So you mentioned this disparity between the university spending 35% on academics and, you know, the rest on something else. Well, when we bring in money, 10% of that goes back to the people actually teaching the classes in my unit. The rest of it goes to fund many other things in the university. We're basically a source of income for them, which is understandable. That's not a problem. But we do think that it's fair to share more of that with the people who are actually making the university work.
Well, I notice the university is now in the real estate business.
Yes, mm-hmm. But not necessarily in a good way.
Well, my mind's a little bit blown here. I've always known that administrators are well paid, and when I was doing some administrative work, I kind of welcomed it. Though I have to say, I was not. I was on a contract that was based on faculty salaries. And my work was, I later felt, even though I felt well compensated and allowed me to retire earlier, I realized that I was being exploited in the process. Because others would have, the reason why they used me, I think, to a great extent was, first of all, I was convenient and had a good political standing within the academic communities. But the fact of the matter is that if they brought in a university academic dean or something into that position, they would have had to pay a hell of a lot more money. So they do manipulate. They do manipulate to save costs, even as they have people who are making a lot of money. And I don't even understand. I guess there is a notion that these deans and these academic professionals who work managing, and I put quotes around that, the faculty, are just so important, so very, very important. But I'm not getting it. I'm not really understanding why there is this kind of enormous pay disparity between those who are teaching, who actually are on the ground working with students in a very important position, and those who somehow have some management role in the institution. And I see it as part of a process of professionalization in a direction away from the actual role of the university, which I think should be teaching and research.
This is Leanne. So in that same 10-year time period that Ron had mentioned, where we're seeing administrative salaries grow by leaps and bounds and we're seeing faculty salaries either stagnate or decrease, during that same 10-year time period, the primary source of revenue has shifted from having the universities be funded by the state, by state dollars, to having students paying tuition dollars as the primary source of revenue. So as students are paying more, they're getting less. We're seeing a decrease in budgets going towards direct instruction. We're seeing tuition shoot up so that students are going into deep debt just to get university education. And we're seeing the people that are actually doing the teaching being compensated less for the work that they're doing.
Yeah, and I think this is an important political issue around the student's debt. You're much less likely to be able to take jobs working for, let us say, an environmental agency or for any public service job when you have that enormous debt. You're going to want to discharge that debt as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. If you're logical and rational as a student, that means you're going to work for the man, as we used to say. And you're going to be part of a more conservative environment for professional people and for people with higher degrees. I think that's an important part of the picture. Mm-hmm. I want to go to the phones again. 231-8187, who do we got? Who? Mitch. Hi, Mitch.
Yeah, hi. I've been listening to this discussion and remembering when I was an undergrad at Berkeley in the 80s, mm-hmm. and all this conservative money was coming onto the campus from the Simon Foundation and the Scaife Foundation to basically do a PR campaign indicating that the tenure track positions on major American universities were the bastion of communists and socialists. And what I kept seeing as an undergraduate was that, in fact, all the career advancement and all the government contracts were going to people who were working on the kind of maybe liberal but neoliberal economic model that now your faculty members on this program are bemoaning. And then I had a company move me from California to Oregon because Oregon is a work-at-will state, and they could have the flexibility to terminate people without reason and without notice, and found out that very few people, or my coworkers here in Oregon, even knew the difference between a work-at-will state or a right-to-work state, and that KABU, on their own labor shows, had staff that didn't know the difference or didn't know what work-at-will is. So my question to your guests now is, what have they done in their personal lives to spread any information about the cost the cost-benefit analysis of what work-at-will has actually cost Oregon working class? Because the argument made for work-at-will is that it, you know, Oregon is a state that is handicapped with very little job creation, although it used to be an industrial dynamo with Gunderson and all the companies here. But nevertheless, they got work-at-will passed on the notion that if you didn't give employers this benefit of the flexibility, and after all, the workers have the same right to leave any job without giving notice. So, of course, it's you know, there is a symmetry there. But the fact is, no one has ever pushed, and your guests who are academics have the ability to push for an actual cost-benefit analysis. Just like with NAFTA, there's been no media cost-benefit analysis of what NAFTA has cost us. So one trade bill after another gets floated in the image of NAFTA, and the workers don't even realize they're voting against their own interests because the mass of workers are not union represented and can't negotiate the way your guests can.
Well, I think you're making a very good point, and I would add that my personal values and my personal goal would be to see the workforce in America universally in organized labor so that they would have the power to negotiate. But I'm going to let our guests respond, if that's okay.
You.
I may not be able to speak to all those issues. I haven't personally done some of those cost-benefit analyses, although I think that should be done. One thing that I've definitely been involved in, because PSUFA is part of the American Federation of Teachers, I'm on the AFT Oregon State Executive Council, and we do a lot of work throughout the state concerning ballot initiatives. Many people have seen these initiatives over the years sponsored by people like Bill Sizemore, Lauren Parks, Kevin Mannix. They usually center on one or two of the same bad ideas back again and again. And they basically try to tell people that they shouldn't be able to be involved in any kind of political activity through their union. They shouldn't be allowed to have voluntary deduction from dues that they can use to fund political activities. But on the other hand, corporations can pump money into the initiative system. And there's a ballot initiative that I think they're just gathering signatures for now, which they've deceptively titled, I think, Worker Freedom, or we'll see the, you know, what exactly the title ends up being. But it's another one of these Bill Sizemore-inspired issues, and it's trying to give people a very false choice. It's trying to claim that their tagline is, you shouldn't be forced to join a union, which is patently false. You're not forced to join a union. It's how democracy in the workplace works. If people get together and they form a union, conditions generally go up for everybody. You know, I've yet to see an analysis where somebody says, gee, the cost of my dues are so high that I'm just really not making it. It would be better not to have the union. When you really do the math, you see that the cost of union dues is a tiny percentage of the wages, benefits, and working conditions that you get. But they try to make this, you know, like I say, a false choice and another bad initiative.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. We've just barely scraped the surface of these issues. We may come back to this at some future time. I hope so. I want to thank you all for being here. I want to wish you luck particularly the AAUP in this particular struggle. I think we've barely touched on some of the issues involved. And I want to urge our audience to stay tuned to KBOO. Remember, we are the only radio station that presents this kind of radio programming that tries to deal with real issues in a fundamental way. So stay tuned and keep listening. We also, by the way, have the best in music in the world. And I want to also remind y'all that you should make contributions to the station. We exist on your support.
Tuesday night from 10 p.m. to midnight, KBOO brings you the Anjali and the Kid Show with DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid. Post-national bass, folk, and urban sounds that'll knock you upside the head.
It's Anjali and the Kid every Tuesday night on KBOO.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on alternative radio, journalist and professor Rami Khoury speaks on the unfinished Arab revolutions. At 10, Flashpoints features an update on Honduras, where grassroots activists claim the ruling party stole the recent presidential election. Also, peace activists continue to get arrested resisting the building of a massive military base in South Korea. At 11 on Stage and Studio, join host Dime Roberts for conversation and a live concert with members of the Christmas Revels and the Vagabond Opera. We'll hear tales and accordion music. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Jim Riswald will be Ava Lake's guest. They will talk about his latest show, Art for Oncologists. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for this community radio station. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now here's Alternative Radio.
So I think we need to keep in mind, while we're looking at internal changes within